All right, let's go to the phone line where we have Clark Williams Derry on the phone line with the Institute for Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the program here today. And first of all, before we get into the study that you guys have just recently, my journalism language needs to get to the 2.0 and get to the modern times. So your company, your organization, Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, first of all, just flows off the tongue. Secondly, what is the IEEFA?
We call it IEFA.
IEFA, okay.
It's an organization that looks at the energy transition. We do research, mostly financial and economic research, on issues related to the oil and gas industry, coal, but also the transition to renewable energy. So we try to make sure that all of our research is nonpartisan, it's unbiased. We're trying to do our best to represent reality as the way we see it. So,
well, that was my next question: how are you guys funded? So it's a nonpartisan. It's just go ahead.
Yeah, it's funded mostly through philanthropic donations. There are philanthropies that want to make sure that there's good information out there about the energy transition, and we mostly get our money that way. We don't really have a membership base. That's the question. So.
Yeah, and one of the ways that I thought this was an interesting study that you have just recently put out, and because we're one of the few outlets out there that will challenge the industry from time to time in a respectful, thoughtful, in like one way we're doing right now is asking the question, is $100 oil the new $50 oil? And it's a thought, it's a thought exercise because of the regulations, inflation, all kinds. There's a bunch of different reasons to look at it.
Yeah.
And yours has the Bakken peaked. Of course, the Bakken is my home shale play. I always look at people down in Texas. Well, they got the Permian as their home base, or the Haynesville, or if you're in Wyoming, you got the Powder River. The Bakken would be my home base, and that's been one that's been up and down. And it's when it first came out, it just was the world-class shale play, and it had all kinds of leaders in the marketplace from the core data library to just the sweet crude that was almost refined the second it came out of the ground. And then it's had a couple of growing pains, Oh, we forgot to carry the one. You need more water. Oh, we forgot to carry the one there. And and all of a sudden the 30-year play is a 20-year play. And now this new one that's out is more of the geographical locations and just some of the ducks, how they're not holding up to what they were before. So I do want to talk about this study a little bit, maybe even challenge it. Let's talk a little bit. Give kind of the executive summary of this study that's titled "Has the Bakken Peaked?" Because I'll tell you what, you caught my attention with that headline.
Yeah, right. Well, so we don't answer the question about whether the Bakken has peaked, and that's really going to depend a lot on what happens to oil prices and the market in general. It's hard to say. Like one of the best ways to be wrong about the future is to make a prediction about the future. So we're just sort of raising the question here. But the problem that we're identifying is that many of the best locations, the best drilling locations, have already been drilled. That is, the sweet spots, the core of the core in the Bakken, is already got a lot of drilling activity in it. And there is some data that we were looking at that suggests that there's not a lot of running room left, that they're running short of new high-quality drilling sites. Now, in a place as large as the Bakken, that doesn't necessarily mean that that the production's over. But what it does mean is that in the future, as those high-quality drilling sites are exhausted or tapped out, that you're going to have to move into lower-quality drilling sites that produce less oil and less gas. They have worse economics. And the result is that over time, the break-even costs for drilling or the break-even price that's needed to drill a new well is going to rise, and it's going to make it harder for shale companies to make money. Now, that doesn't mean they won't make money, because obviously a lot's going to depend on the price, and if $100 a barrel of oil for oil is the new 50, then maybe there's some more running room to go. But if oil prices drop that back down to the $50, $60 range, you may start having some real growing pains, some difficulty in sustaining today's level of production economically. And so that's really what we looked at.
My question, which might be a naive question, but if the sweet spot and the best locations have already been drilled, is it just sheer economics after that? Is that, this site is just too far outside of a comfort zone for our economics? Is that what we're talking here?
That's pretty much it. Yeah. We used a data set called IHS Market, which is one of the big industry standard data sets. And one of the things that IHS Market does is it gives you an estimate of the break-even price that is needed to drill a new well. And you can see in the core of the core, Bakken wells do pretty well. They line up pretty well with, say, wells in the Permian, in other places. They're productive, and they produce a lot of oil, produce some gas, and they can break even when oil prices, according to IHS, they can break even at $40 or $42 a barrel. But as you get farther out away from the core, that price goes up to $50, $60, north of $60 in some cases. And so then it's just a question of, well, how many drilling sites are left? How many good, high-quality wells are left? And how many places are sort of farther away from the core that has, less oil and gas trapped under the ground in the shale layers? And that's where the thing that opened my eyes when we looked and we saw what IHS was saying about the number of drilling sites, the high-quality drilling sites remaining. It looked like the Bakken had only a year or two left of high-quality drilling sites at previous, at basically previous drilling rates. It's hard to know what's going to happen in reality. The industry is always evolving, always discovering new ways of doing things. It may be able to sort of figure out ways of boosting production, but the way things are looking right now is that there's only a few years left of the very best drilling sites, maybe 2-3 years. And then you're going to start moving into higher cost wells that, they cost the same as a high quality well, but they produce less oil and gas.
Did you just say there's only 2-3 years left of quality Bakken drilling sites?
That was what our research showed. The numbers, it's going to depend on what the industry does, how they pick and choose their sites from here on out. But, we looked at things, and at the the high end, we're thinking around 700 or so high quality, that's top quintile wells, drilling sites were left, as identified by this IHS data set. And the industry, prior to the COVID turndown, was drilling somewhere in the range of 650, 700 of these high quality wells a year. So it was looking like there was not a lot of space left. Now, at today's lower rates of drilling, there you might be able to sort of piece things out for another few years. But really, what we're trying to point out is that once those high quality drilling sites are gone, however many there are, the economics of the Bakken are going to decline.
The first time I heard the word quintile was in the oil and gas industry, by the way. I just thought I'd point that out.
Oh, yeah, quintile. That's like something that like rolls off my tongue. It just means the top 20% the top quintile is the top 20% of wells that have ever been drilled in the Bakken, kind of. And, over time, what's happened is that the industry's gotten better and better at drilling good wells. When I say good wells, they're wells that produce a lot of oil and gas. And they've been doing that in two ways. One is they've been improving the drilling technology. The other is that they've been targeting the sweet spots. They've been learning more and more about where the best sites to drill are. And so what we've seen is that more and more of the wells have been, you know, sort of basically targeted right at the best places using the best technologies and best methods. But you know, you can do all you can do with technology, but if the oil and gas just isn't there underground, it's going to be hard to make a well really economic the way that you know, wells in other parts of the country might be. And so this in some ways may help explain why the Bakken has sort of hasn't really bounced back as hard as some other parts of the country. I mean, like if you look at back at the history of the Bakken, like you said, early on in the fracking boom, there were regularly more than 200 rigs operating in the basin. And that went on for, you know, 2011, 12, 13. Then there's a big price decline. The first big price drop from in 2014, 15, 16, you know, when prices went from more than $100 a barrel regularly to, I guess, around $30 a barrel in 2016. And, you know, you saw the rig count fall from the 200s down to the 20s. Then, you know, over time, 2017, 18, 19, the rig count sort of clawed its way back up to the high 50s. That is 50 or more rigs operating. Actually, it's more like 57, 58, 59. But then the Bakken really got thrown for a loop by COVID, and the rig count fell below, I think it fell to 9 rigs operating at the very depth of the COVID crisis. Now it's back up to 27, which is 3 times the low point at the you know, sort of when things were really, you know, really bad for the Bakken and for the oil industry in the depths of COVID. So it's 3 times as good as it was, you know, in terms of, you know, as many rigs, I should say, as it was in you know, the depths of COVID, but still less than half of what it was pre-COVID. And so one of the questions was, well, why isn't, you know, Bakken oil production rebounding so much? I mean, we've got high oil prices. Why aren't people flooding back into the Bakken to take advantage of the oil that's there? And one of the answers looks like is that there isn't a lot of running room in the Bakken, and that producers that, you know, that overproduce now are going to have some trouble producing enough later on. You know, it's like the faster they boost their production now to take advantage of high prices, the less running room they have in their well inventory. So I think that things might have slowed down in the Bakken some, not just because of you know, the, you know, uncertainty about COVID and, you know, what's going to happen with the Omicron variant and that sort of thing. You know, there is still a lot of uncertainty in global oil demand, but I think that one of the big issues that the Bakken is now facing is that it's running into some geologic limits, and the industry is sort of aware that that the faster it drills now, the less time the Bakken oil industry is going to be economic.
One of the things I did like about your study, has the Bakken peaked? Exhaustion of high quality drilling sites that could point to falling oil output. Is that really, it was almost like an audit, really, more than anything. It did take a pretty sterile look at the Bakken, and, you know, I sent it out to a few people, and of course they slung back a few questions and a few other things, but the questions are more have to do with innovations and oil prices, and that's why I was like, no, guys, this is more of like, where are we now, and how we approach the future is up to us. And when I look at some of the regulatory things coming into place, the Bakken doesn't have a lot of wiggle room, because if they start getting regulatory pressure coming in, I mean, I think over 90% of it's, you know, private minerals, and then
right.
but there is the federal part, and then you start talking about some of the some of the overlapping layers, and that becomes problematic. But for the most part, the Bakken has had experienced a pretty business-friendly environment. So there's not a lot of room. I have been hearing some good news on the innovation side when it comes to some of the DUCs and some of the oil enhancement recoveries. How in-depth did you guys get on either the oil enhancement portion of the Bakken or the DUCs on that part?
Well, we did take a look at the duck inventory, and that's sort of an interesting story. That one of the ways the industry has been cutting costs, you know, and especially in 2020 when prices were so low, early 2021, but it's continued today, is that they are drawing down the inventory of drilled but uncompleted wells, DUCs. For a long time, according to EIA, the Bakken had around 800 or so, sometimes closer to 900 DUCs in the inventory. And that was true from the 2016 to about mid-2020s. But since then, the industry has been steadily drawing down that DUC inventory. And, you know, at the moment, I just looked at the numbers earlier today. Let's see if I can get a hold of those. For the Bakken, they say there's under 500 DUCs that are left. And if you look at that, at the numbers of wells that are being drilled, it's about a six and a half month supply of DUCs. Usually the industry likes to have about a 5 month supply of DUCs on hand at least, because that's, you know, you can't just drill a well and then complete it the next day. There's a sort of a process involved. So they like to have, you know, like a sort of a backlog of drilled but uncompleted wells that they can go to and frack and complete when prices are right and when it sort of meets their capital spending plans. But the real story here is that there was a pretty robust supply of DUCs, drilled but uncompleted wells, but that has been dwindling since COVID hit. The industry has been drawing down that inventory, and it's getting pretty close to the point where they're going to start to need to drill some more because they're running out of the surplus DUCs, if you will. And I'm very curious to hear what you've been hearing about the technology improvements in the Bakken. Because it's one area where you can really see technology, you know, it hasn't, you know, there's still experimentation and innovation going on. So I'm interested to hear about that.
Yeah, we've got an interview scheduled with a couple companies next week on some of their new innovations that they're bringing into it. Credence Energy Services is one of them. They've got some new, I don't know if it's a chemical or something or not.
Yeah.
And then I'm hoping to get an update on the economics about the well pads and the well sites. You know, I mean, I did a story back in, 2016 or 15. It was during the downturn. And one of the positives that came out of the downturn was, you know, companies like Continental were seeing their well pads go from 11 million down to 8, down to 6 million, you know, in terms of the total costs. Did you guys go into that in any way, either the savings part of it or maybe even I saw that you guys had some inflations. I saw that your organization inflation thrown in there too. So talk to me about some of that a little bit.
Yeah, so inflation is one of those things that's especially for the oil field services industry, that's going to be tough to figure out. You know, if you look at the most recent numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it looks to me as though inflation in the oil patch is pretty high right now. That is, you know, if you look at oil country tubular goods, you have the piping, steel costs are high, things are more expensive, labor starting to get more expensive. And so, and on the other hand, there's been a tendency towards you know, cost reductions over time. And so better technologies and better use of technology that, you know, brings down the cost of drilling. And it's not clear how these two forces are sort of going to interact with one another going forward. I mean, it could be that prices, the cost of drilling stays roughly stable because, you know, there'll be inflation, from, you know, from just general economic forces. But then there's also an innovation that brings down costs. Or it could be that inflation outpaces the innovation, or the vice versa. So it's one of those things that's really hard to know what to do with. You know, how do you forecast inflation in oil field services? Now, one of the things that happened during that big, you know, that big downturn in costs, like when oil prices, you know, went from $100 a barrel to $30 a barrel, the industry learned how to innovate and reduce costs. But the other thing that happened at the same time was that oil field services companies they basically overinvested, and they used to be able to command, you know, when prices were $100 a barrel, they could command high fees, high costs for doing the work. And there were labor shortages. And, you know, like the cost of drilling was high, in part because the technology wasn't as advanced, but probably in greater part because just the cost of everything was high. You remember when, you know, the Bakken was booming and, you know, it was hard to find a hotel room, and hotel rooms were going for hundreds of dollars a night, that sort of thing. Those things affected costs as well. And so when the prices collapsed, you saw oil field services companies charging less for their services. You saw just generally a reduction in the cost level for the industry. So there's sort of a combination of things. And so right now that we're in an inflationary period, you could wind up seeing a higher cost for oil producers. And that'll be, you know, the industry will be, of course, trying to fight back and figure out how to lower costs as best it can.
I think right now is a very critical time for a lot of companies, because they're coming off of 2 years of manufactured business. It was, you know, I mean, you can't put $7 trillion into the marketplace without, you know, at least getting some crumbs. And so at the same time, a lot of people had taken reductions in salary, or they cut their costs to oil companies and a number.
Yeah.
So on one hand, you had people cutting their own internal costs, making sacrifices in order to keep
That's
business.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you had the government pumping in whatever it was, $4, 5, 7 trillion.
Yeah, after, right.
You know, there was 2 years of, in fact, they just did one for whatever the trillion was for the infrastructure, and they're talking about a new one now with another $4.5 trillion. This is all inflated marketplace because it's being pumped in. I wonder how much of that is really being included with some of this. That was one of the areas that I was going to challenge you on the study is the inflation, because, you know, I just talked to Senator Cramer, and he's already talking about right now we're at 6-7% inflation, and your highest case only has a 2% inflation. And I'm going, oh man, this is even this study's hard to do, and you're trying to be aggressive.
So that was a choice. Like, the faster that the drilling cost inflation rises, the harder it is for the Bakken long term, because the lower quality wells are a lot more expensive than sort of lower quality wells in the Permian, for example. You know, if you look at the cost in the Bakken, the top tier of wells are really competitive. The second tier, like the second quintile, second 20%, they're okay. But when you get down to that third, the middle tier, which is where like the number of drilling sites actually starts to skyrocket, they're in a much worse position relative to places like the Permian. And so if you start getting, you know, exhausting your top two tiers, then you get into this more expensive, these more expensive drilling sites, the ones that require higher prices. But then if your inflation rate is too high, then that plays even harder against the Bakken compared to some of the other basins in the country. Because, you know, if you have, you know, basically inflating the cost of $53 a barrel oil versus, you know, $42 a barrel oil, this is an example, you know 20% of 50, you know, of 53 is going to be like, it's going to be 60, and you know, 20% of 42 is going to be 50. And so you wind up with, you know, basically inflation magnifying the differences between basins. I kept our inflation rate low because, you know, it's hard to know what's going to happen. You could see, for example, a decline in you know, let's say inflation comes back to Earth. And I sort of projected 6%, and then it turns out it's only going to be 2% between innovations and lower inflation rate. We try to keep ourselves conservative without and try not to sort of price the future out too high. If that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. That's why I was saying, even on the aggressive one, it's hard to even know. And so that's why I kind of said, for a lot of people, big part of this is the just where are we at now? And anytime there's a future scenario, I think a lot of people have to obviously look at what's best for their individual niche or their industry part. You know, a lot of it too is, you mentioned, I think we're down to, was it 7 or 9? I forget, in the Bakken at its low point, and then it's up to higher 20s now. Yeah. And people forget, because it's not mentioned very often, it was $67 million of that COVID money went to the oil companies to keep them in the state. And so that was an inflated marketplace too. And I do wonder if that is going to, is that going to hurt at all? Or will that be enough to keep them? Because oil companies have never hid the fact that once they don't make money, they'll leave. That's what I've always respected about the oil companies. They've never hid from that fact that when the numbers aren't there, we're gone, pal. That's just the way it goes. So I don't know if that kind of went into there at all, or even maybe some of the new, this new bill with the abandoned wells, because that is another part of revenue that oil gas companies are now putting into their bids are, the abandoned wells and orphan wells, because that's work. Yeah. Hey, it's work,
And it is work. And that's a great, I think it's something that needs a lot more attention. I think that it's employs the same people who are doing kind of the same kinds of work. And, it's a desperate need. There's a lot of wells in the Bakken that all need to be plugged, and cleaning up after the party, that's a big part of the employment picture there. But you mentioned, the idea that oil companies are upfront that they're going to leave when they're, when the economics stop working. And you probably saw not so long ago that that Continental, one of the, probably one of the premier Bakken drillers, just took on a big purchase in the Permian. So I think there are already signs that the industry in the Bakken is starting to look elsewhere for its future prospects. I mean, that's nothing definitive there. I mean, a lot of people are looking at the Permian, but, and the other thing was also true about the Bakken is that even, for a long time, there's a lot of hope about the Bakken and there really was like a ton of oil produced. It was just, went from basically nothing to one of the nation's premier oil producing regions. But a lot of the oil companies that were involved were actually struggling to generate cash for a lot of that period. Even when prices were high, the drilling costs were high. When prices were lower, it's hard to make money when oil's at, 30 or 40 bucks a barrel. And so you even saw, some of the major drillers, Whiting and Oasis, these are kind of the big boys in the Permian, and they went bankrupt. They declared bankruptcy. They had to write off a lot of their debt. So, I think that there's, in addition to, I guess, some trepidation about the region's future and the quality of the wells that are remaining, I think there's also a recognition that a lot of the excitement about the Bakken, it was about the quantity of oil and the improvements in the technology, but the finances were always challenged. The finances were always challenged, and you had a number of companies. If you're not in prime acreage, you're not doing, sort of hitting your mark all the time, they were having a hard time. They're struggling at the corporate level to generate cash. Now, that's fine for as long as Wall Street's willing to sort of, loan you money or buy more stock, then you can sort of sustain that. But once Wall Street gets kind of sick of that game, it's difficult for these companies to sort of expand and grow quickly. And I think that's one of the part of the story we're seeing right now is that oil companies are actually perfectly happy to produce a little bit less right now. And they're happy to produce less for two reasons. One, because drilling costs, the cost of drilling is always a big part of the financial picture for a company. And if they can drill less, they actually spend less on drilling, they can generate more cash, they can give back to investors and pay down their debt. But the other thing that's going on is that companies that overproduce run the risk of driving down prices again. You know, if the U.S. oil industry starts going gangbusters again, well, that just drives prices down and it makes their profits that much harder to find. So I think in a way right now we're in a position where the oil industry in the U.S. is actually perfectly happy producing less because they're spending less and they're making more.
Yeah, a lot of the chatter is coming from the supply chain, you know, the service companies and then of course the organizations, but I don't hear much coming out of the oil and gas companies these days, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they are, you know, they're biding their time in a way. This is the kind of the moment they've been waiting for. I mean, oil prices have been in the 70s and 80s. They're generating boatloads of cash. You know, and frankly, they've been generating boatloads of cash after more than a decade of really dismal financial performance. I mean, that's one of the things we've looked at my organization is the ability of the fracking companies, fracking focused companies, to generate cash. And ultimately, what investors want is they want these companies to be spending less than they're earning. They want free cash flow, you know, cash that can go back to investors to pay down the debt or to pay off dividends, pay dividends to their stockholders. And the industry wasn't doing that for a long time. You know, even during the boom times, you know, what we saw was essentially sort of it was an oil production boom, but a financial bust. And that was the sort of thing that led to the bankruptcies of Oasis and Whiting, is that, you know, at a corporate level, they were producing a lot of oil, but they weren't producing a lot of cash and they had a lot of debt to service.
Sorry, I'm writing down some notes here.
No problem.
As I'm doing that. And I wanted to ask you about pipelines, rail, takeaway, that sort of thing. Of course, geography has never worked in the Bakken's favor unless they're going to sell to Canada. And so, honestly, that's probably the best idea at this point that I just said. Reverse that pipeline from the Keystone and have it go up to Calgary from the Bakken. There we go. instead of vice versa, right? So let's talk about that a little bit, because I always forget, you know, the big controversial pipeline really doesn't even help the Bakken out. It helps Canada out, which helps the industry, which helps the Bakken.
Yeah.
But
from
the Bakken specifically, I know there's a Bridger pipeline, and I believe there's another one. Is it Enbridge or... I don't have my notes handy, but I know there's a couple pipelines that would help the Bakken in terms of price and profitability and help the companies out. Did you guys go into detail or look at that at all?
We looked a little bit at the pipeline situation. More generally, we looked at the takeaway capacity in the Bakken. And this is actually something that's a little bit interesting to me, that you know, there's obviously tons of oil by rail capacity. Most of it is unused. There's still a little bit of oil going from the Bakken to the Pacific Northwest, a little bit to the East Coast, to a couple of refineries that don't have pipeline access. But for the most part, you know, there's this enormous amount of oil by rail infrastructure that was built early on in the Bakken boom, when there was basically there's no other way to get the oil out of the Bakken. Now that all that is basically sitting unused, idle. Then there are a bunch of other pipelines, and you know, there's a handful of other pipelines. There's a refinery in the Bakken region that's serviced, you know, mostly from local crude. But there's actually a fair amount of unused pipeline space remaining, and this could be a trouble for some companies that have made long-term commitments to buy pipeline space. You know, that a lot of these pipelines were built basically on the back of long-term take-or-pay contracts, and a take-or-pay contract basically means you either take the capacity of the pipeline or you pay a penalty. And, you know, for companies that basically bought pipeline space, they're kind of locked into those contracts for the long term, but those pipelines are not full right now. I mean, there's a fair amount of capacity left in and, you know, between DAPL and the other pipelines, there's a fair amount of capacity that is appears to be unused right now. And so that actually winds up being a cost center for oil companies. They've paid essentially for the pipeline space, but production is a lot lower than they thought it was going to be, and they're not using that pipeline space. It raises questions about, you know, what's the long-term financial burden of carrying those pipeline obligations? And it also, this also may help to explain why companies are reluctant to overproduce now, because they may in the short term, be able to sort of use that pipeline space and not pay the penalties. But in the long term, they just run the risk of paying even higher penalties in the future if they're not able to fill their sort of pipeline quotas. So, so we took a little bit of a look at the pipeline situation. And what we see is that between, you know, lots of unused rail capacity and lots of unused pipeline capacity, there's still a lot of, you know, basically takeaway capacity for oil in the Bakken that's not being used right now. And, you know, unless oil production volumes go up, is probably never, you know, may never be used.
I know Meridian Energy Group, boy, they keep moving ahead trying to get that refinery out there in Belfield, North Dakota. And that would take, you know, 49,000 barrels a day right there locally. Yeah. It's just interesting, you know, when you start looking at just policy direction and you know, just in back in my day, I come from the publishing industry. And so we went through our paradigm shift with the internet. And I lost, I tell people all the time, I've made it through four or five recessions, seven if you want to count three or four in the last couple of years. But I did lose the 2009 one. I had to bankrupt one of my companies. And but every newspaper in America had to over the next 10 years. And that's what I tell people is that I don't feel bad because every newspaper that had a monopoly for 100 years basically had to file bankruptcy over the next 10 years because of the internet. And a big part of that was is because they would not let go of their printing press, their investment in sunk costs.
Right.
And I do wonder how many state governments right now have, you know, sunk costs, whether it be companies or infrastructure or whatever the case might be. And then, you know, when I think of that in North Dakota, I go to that 11.5% tax. There's an extraction and production tax. And it seems to be one of the higher in the nation. It was at one time the highest in the nation, the two different taxes. And at one point, boy, I think it was 55% of the North Dakota state budget was dependent on those two taxes. I mean, you want to talk about putting all your eggs into a basket. That's a sunk cost, pal. But did you guys get into any of that economics, the taxes or, you know, anything like that? Because I know a lot of oil companies are always trying to get their taxes down.
Oh, of course they are. I mean, it's you know, like you say, if it's 55% of the state budget, I don't know that's the number, but it doesn't surprise me if it is.
That did include license and registration fees and driver's license taxes. No, that was just the general budget tax. Fund. Oh man, it was. In fact, some reports had it up to like 65%. Anyways.
And so, I mean, you can understand why the state government would be really excited to keep the oil industry moving forward. And, you know, we saw projections, you know, from politicians in 2019, as recently as 2019, that the, you know, Bakken boom would continue indefinitely. And they kind of need it to in some ways. It's almost like, you know, you become dependent on that oil and gas revenue. Of course, there are costs. I mean, the cost of roads. I mean, there were a bunch of costs that the state government was essentially picking up on behalf of the oil and gas industry. But you can understand why a state government is especially nervous about a decline in oil production, because a decline in oil production means a decline in revenues for the state. And I think that some of the confident predictions that oil would be booming for indefinitely, when you look at the numbers, you know, on the well side, it looks a little bit like whistling in the dark, that they're just trying to tell themselves a story that North Dakota is going to be fine, it's going to be just fine, when there actually are some dark clouds on the horizon. Now, of course, as I say, you know, the best way to be wrong about a prediction is to make one. So I'm not sure. I'm not really predicting that there is a The Bakken has peaked, the production won't rise again. But I am saying that there's a fundamental geological reality here that most of the best wells have already been drilled. The sort of sweet spot, the core of the core, is pretty well saturated. And there's some running room left, but not a lot.
Oh, I think you're starting to see signs more than just continental resources going into other shale plays. And I saw there was a Conoco, I think, sold some Bakken assets recently as well.
Yeah.
And Nesset, of course, Kathy Nesset, who is known as the godmother of the Bakken with Nesset Consulting, she rebranded to Nesset. And now they're doing some wind turbine work. And I saw that was
interesting.
That was a feature story in Oil Man magazine, was their wind turbine transitional work. And she's a major player out in the Bakken. So when you're starting to see some major signs like that happen, I think it's, you know, there should be some more talk than just you and I,
I guess that's what I'm
trying to say. Well, a lot of people invested a lot of money in the Bakken, and the story's changed multiple times. So, I do appreciate studies like yours that take a more a sterile approach, because, like you say, you guys are funded by people trying to make money in the industry and trying to, you know, just want some good information that is not supposed to be a cheerleader as much as, hey, this is where we're at. Figure out a way to turn it into cheerleading. go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I would say that probably most of our funders are not trying to make money in the industry, but they definitely want to know what the industry is, what it's up to, and what its financial prospects are. So.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. And so what is next for a study like this then? Like I said, I like studies like this because I like to read this type of information rather than the summaries given to me. Somebody sent me a summary of your study. So I went to the actual study and read your study because that's how I operate.
Good for you.
Well, because a special interest group just highlights three or four different things that you say, and then they try to say, this is what you're saying, and I know that's not the case.
Right.
And so anyway, what's next for something like this? I mean, would you guys do a follow-up study? Would you take a look at some different angles since you've already accumulated some of this data?
Yeah, I think that probably the next step for me would be to keep tracking the trends in the Bakken as they evolve. And in particular, keep looking at the data on how well is the industry doing at bringing down costs? Or, for example, are costs starting to rise because of the general inflation pressures on the drilling sector? I think really one of the key issues moving forward is going to be on the cost of drilling. Because if the industry innovates, and if it is able to bring down costs, you may be able to see, the Bakken have a little bit more of a financial lifespan, if you will. But if inflation takes hold and there really is a gradual decline in the quality of new wells, then you may see the industry, voting with its feet and starting to move into other basins or just leave the Bakken alone. Like you say, the oil industry is very clear. Like when it's not making money, it's happy to leave. And for the time being, it's making money using the strategy of drilling a little bit, but not too much. But we'll have to see how long that lasts.
And let's be clear. When we say that the oil industry, they're happy making money and they'll leave when they're not making money, they're happy spending money too. And they make sure everybody in that community is making money. When the times are good, times are good. And when the spigot is turned off, well, go figure it out, because they have to.
It's tough. I mean, in general, I would say the oil and gas economy is like a roller coaster. Sometimes it's fun, but sometimes it's kind of gut wrenching. When you're on the way up, everything feels like it's going to be just fine. But then sometimes the bottom drops out, and you're in for a difficult ride. So there's a real, I guess, sort of a volatility, a fundamental volatility, and a lot of that has to do with just the pure unpredictability of the oil price. When prices are high, things tend to be good for producers and bad for consumers. When prices are low, things tend to be good for consumers and bad for producers. And it's really hard to find a sort of a middle ground that works for everybody. And, you know, frankly, like you pointed out, that, you know, the cost of wind is coming down in some parts of the country. The cost of solar is coming down, and those are starting to create some real pressures for the oil industry on a macro level. And you can sort of start to see it in the gas industry, because you know if you're making electricity from wind and solar, well, your fuel source is free, and so that, you know, with high gas prices, high natural gas prices that we're seeing right now, the higher the price of natural gas is, the more attractive wind and solar are. And so that's becoming a little bit of a headwind for the industry in parts of the country.
You know, that natural gas price might be the one sneaky inflationary thing no one's talking about. Everyone's talking about, but nobody's understanding, because a lot of people get their bills 30 days later. And
that's right.
So yeah. It almost becomes like a sticker shock. And then they get their first one, and then they start thinking, wait a minute, is this the next 6 months? Because I only budgeted X amount.
That's right. That's yeah. right. No, that's a real, it's a real issue for consumers. And, you know, there's not a lot you can do in the short term to protect yourself from gas, spiking gas prices.
No.
You can turn down the heat a little bit, but that's about it. I mean, I know that I'm actually interested, you know, in getting located in Seattle, and we've been starting to get crazy heat waves in the summertime. So I'm looking to get a heat pump, and I may wind up getting a heat pump that, heats the house and cools the house. And that's, you know, that might sort of give me a little bit of a break from the spiking price of natural gas here.
I keep thinking about the entire movement to the cloud, which takes all kinds of air conditioners to keep these servers cool. But then at the same time, the spike of natural gas prices is doing a number on the supply chain because of, you know, we talked about steel earlier. Man, that's like the number one concern with people is the price of steel, because it just keeps going up and up and up. And it hasn't slowed down.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, you know, you see in the global economy right now, there are inflationary pressures all over the place. You know, the price of rubber, the price of computer chips, used cars, you know, oddball foodstuffs. I mean, you know, pretty much wherever you look, you see some sign of inflation. And a lot of that just has to do with, you know, with COVID. I mean, I think there's a big try to blame one politician or another politician for high costs, but you know, sort of, you forget that there's a big integrated global supply chain, and that, you know, because of COVID, links in that chain are just missing from time to time, and so it's just stuff goes missing, and so prices, you know, when supply isn't there, the prices skyrocket. So I mean, I'm sort of the view that as long as COVID is sort of rippling through the global economy, you're going to see this kind of inflation. I mean, that's one of the reasons that, you know, that we've seen inflation so far is over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months. There's pent up demand from people who were sick of, you know, being indoors during the worst of the lockdowns, and you know, that's true around the world, not just in the U.S. But then also, there are places where there's just gaps in the supply chain, and that is going to drive prices up.
Well, I couldn't even imagine, you know, trying to navigate the logistics behind an oil company right now. From you got the truckers who have a legitimate complaint or beef to raise their prices because of just the sheer gasoline prices.
And
everybody from the, you know, temporary housing people that have an on-site chef because food prices have gone up so much. I mean, so everywhere, you're not a kid, man. And then the rubber and the steel, every which way you turn around, every single supply chain has got a legitimate, say, hey, we need more.
It's certainly an issue. It is certainly an issue. And you know, there's only so much that, you know, that any of us can do. You know, we are victims of the global supply chain as well as beneficiaries. So, you know, when things are working smoothly, prices are, you know, everything's cheap. Things, but, you know, when things are not working so well, then you're going to see expensive things, the prices spiking all over the place. I mean, it is one thing to remember, though, that, you know, as high as oil prices are right now, you know, it's in the 70s over the past week or so, it was as high as the 80s. But, you know, prior to 2014, oil prices regularly topped $100 a barrel. So, you know, we got used to cheap oil, but that really has only been around since 2016 or so, for the past, you know, 5 years. And that was, of course, at a time when the oil industry itself was struggling because, you know, well, the oil industry actually, you know, just the way the economics work, it needs higher prices to thrive.
Well, I appreciate you coming on today. I'm looking at the time and it's almost been an hour already and I could go another,
oh, wow.
I know I could go another 4 hours on something like this because I got 100 more questions for you, but let's give you a plug for your organization. And if you got any future studies coming out, the one we're talking about is if the Bakken has peaked, and we'll have the links, of course, at the Crude Life's website along with the interview. But are you guys working, is your organization working on any other studies right now, or are you soliciting for any sort of philanthropy, or just talk about, you know, how we can help you guys?
Oh, no, that's a great question. No, we're always looking for ideas for future work. I mean, I want to keep tracking the Bakken for sure. I've been very interested in the issue that you brought up earlier, the DUC issue, the drilled but uncompleted wells, and taking a look at that maybe at the national level. It seems like there, as the industry has drawn down its supply of drilled but uncompleted wells, it had a big surplus, and now it's gradually eating through that surplus. It may face some cost escalation moving forward because they're not going to be able to just, you know, take one of their ducks off the shelf and complete it. They're going to have to actually ramp up drilling, and that could be, you know, on the one hand, that's maybe good for drilling companies. On the other hand, it's going to raise the costs of doing business if you're an oil producer. So that's one of the things that I'm going to be thinking about looking at in a more systematic way.
Well, I appreciate the time today. Yeah. And what's the website again that people can find these studies and everything?
It's IEEFA.org. IEEFA.org.